Hi, this is Dave.
This is Dave. My apologies that the initial seminar three was recorded and
didn't go across the airwaves.
I'm re-recording it now.
Just a brief recap, first seminar we talked about stress mastery strategies and tools, and last seminar we talked about the neuroscience of peak performance. We're going to discuss today the peak performance under pressure principles and applications. And then our last seminar next Monday will be about extreme stress strategies. So let's look first at optimum performance mindset. The physical response in your brain and your body to excitement and fear are exactly the same. Your brain and your body does not know the difference. The only difference between excitement and fear is the framing. So with a response to fear or anxiety, we search for what might consciously make sense to connect cause and effect. The association creates a closure. Linking this physical response with a negative meaning leads to fear.
So protection, avoidance, retreat makes sense.
So just before you begin a task, in which there's any increased activation of alertness, heart rate, sweaty palms, instead of automatically linking the anxiety or fear, then looking for what can go wrong. Reframe instantly, such as I'm excited, I'm ready. Or to ask, why am I ready to do what's next?
This provides a framework of anticipatory readiness and boots up an entirely different neural system of possibility, of challenge.
A context of excitement rather than anxiety or fear.
Performance anxiety is an indication of how much we care about something.
Performance and outcome.
It's normal, even necessary, if you're anxious as preparation for a best performance.
So to frame any anxiety as excitement allies with this experience and channels it into an optimal performance.
Consider the need of anxiety as your mind and body preparing itself to perform. To reframe it as challenge and opportunity.
Attention awakens our prefrontal cortex to then look at a current framework and state of mind for this moment.
A key to consistent performance is to electively enter and sustain. An optimum state of mind for a performance task.
Preparation includes self-reflection to identify and monitor the specific state of mind for optimum performance.
Consistency then requires having a systematic strategy to remain grounded so that no subsequent experience or event disrupts that state of flow.
And then a way to reboot if distracted or derailed.
Think about an immediate application of how you get in a state of mind to engage a client.
Focus on that throughout the coaching session.
And sustain that immersion.
When a performer in any endeavor has practiced the same thing for thousands of hours as the next person, outcome is determined more by optimum mental state and effective sustained focus for peak performance. A significant number of studies finds that the most common psychological characteristics for an optimum performance and state of mind include these five things.
Confidence with positive expectations about performance.
Full concentration to focus on the present task. A strong determination and commitment.
Feeling energized,
yet relaxed,
and a mental toughness
of determined focus under pressure.
Mastery of all these aspects
of pressure situations means
being aware of anything
that may distract the emotional triggers, false feelings, that could disrupt that focus.
A routine is effective
because when repeated enough, the brain creates a neuronal path and network
to maintain this as a default mode
to become automatic without requiring effort.
And studies have shown
that athletes who use a pre-performance routine do better than those who do not.
Same
with our work in coaching. How do you get grounded in spirit and focus
to be
entirely engaged
with your
client?
This systematic entry
into an optimum performance state of mind ensures access to the software specific that deliberate practice has developed. A routine can both guide focus and enhance a sense of effectiveness and mastery
for consistency
during a performance or an engagement.
Here's one aspect
taken from sports that may have an application.
See what you think.
The quiet eye
comes from sports science
as a strategy of attention.
The quiet eye is a selective focus on the most significant target
immediately prior to execution of a skill.
The quiet eye is the final step of any performance sequence.
And it's especially helpful when performing under pressure.
It's simply a heightened attention and focus. Eye tracking research on the quiet eye shows that for a precise motor test
like free throw shooting,
putting a surgical number,
experts maintain quiet eye
62%
longer
than non-experts.
Quiet eye is a focus
that specifically increases precision.
Academic, business,
and us as coaching
can learn a great deal
from research and athletic settings
to apply the quiet eye concept.
Focus aligns the energy field of the brain
and has the functional role of readying for the next step.
Quiet eye training enhances a default motor system execution skills
for a specific target or a specific focus.
Sports science shows the benefit of choosing the best visual target
for purposeful and goal-directed eye movement.
For example, when basketball players miss face shots,
they often instantaneously move focus from the rim where the ball is going to the ball itself.
When soccer players miss penalty shots,
it's been found that they may instantly compromise their focus
from the destination at a specific spot
just inside the goal,
perhaps to the goalkeeper.
Distracts the specificity of that ultimate target of scoring a goal,
or an executive is sidetracked
by an emotional reaction to a colleague,
or a coach wonders, am I going to know how to ask the best questions?
So here's an example about how framing can be useful.
A CEO, I'll call Dean,
had a tragedy at his company.
Of a serious accident
and on the job injuries and one death
at one of the operating sites.
In the three months since the accident,
before we met for the first time,
he had stress-related symptoms,
losing sleep, depleted energy,
preoccupation with safety,
and he was functioning way less than his full capacity.
He recognized his responses, his preoccupation, hampered his effectiveness as an executive. I asked Dan what went through his mind the instant he woke up.
His answer was immediately. Before I opened my eyes, I think about what could go wrong today. He described questions about what could he do for a company, how could he not feel helpless, how could he assure the group
there's going to be no more accidents, how could he mitigate any future danger.
He recognized, as we discussed, the mindset he began each day for the three months since that event had been essentially the same
and had set the tone for himself and his corporation.
His concern becoming not only his executive team, but trickle down to each employee.
He knew he had to do something different, but he wasn't quite sure what different was, and nothing had seemed to work.
We began with a very simple approach.
I explained how, as we wake up, we automatically begin thinking about things. We're always asking ourselves questions,
and we just heard the questions he asked himself.
I suggested substituting different questions for a different framework.
I suggested that he write down three questions that would put him in a state of mind. Positive, energetic, engaging, and adaptive.
And first thing, before his feet ever touched the floor, he would take those three questions and answer them.
Questions that would include how I wanted him to make them up himself, ones that would put him in an empowered state, a positive mindset.
Accomplished, unstoppable, his usual sense of things.
The next week at our session, he immediately reported the difference questions had made.
He recognized he had previously begun each day immediately with negative self-talk,
creating a mindset of lack of confidence and stress.
With that mindset, that process the rest of the day for him, by shifting consciously to a positive framework.
He booted up a usual positive mindset that he hadn't really engaged for three months.
That built on itself through the day.
This initial reframing of his self-narrative to direct the power of focus to launch a positive state of mind to engage the day became a model that he had passed on directly and indirectly to his organization.
He noticed within days the impact it had on his executive team and how this change actually permeated the whole organization.
And we also looked at ways whenever he might stop himself or derail or think of something negative, how he could immediately get back to that framing of positive, successful engagement.
Self-talk becomes an internal dialogue that can enhance confidence and then directly enhance performance.
Self-talk is not to counter the negative, because that engages him, whatever we focus on, positive or negative.
But we want to focus on possibilities, on challenges. The unconscious does not know the difference between positive and negative, just the focus.
A positive self-talk in the present moment can immediately replace a negative focus.
It's important to recognize that this is a different set of strategies of self-talk and affirmations.
But it will be different in different performance arenas.
For example, in athletics, a runner may need a focus phrase of powerful and steady when they're doing longer distances.
Or keep your pace during the races.
If it's matched with a particular task.
In golf, for example.
A focus phrase or a self-statement for the tee with a powerful drive may be relaxed and powerful.
In the middle.
In the middle.
of the course,
relaxed and accurate. On the putting green, relaxed and smooth. It needs to fit the task.
It's not
going to help you get to sleep faster, which this can do. If it's done correctly, it's not going to help you get to sleep faster
by saying,
I am the storm, or, you know,
getting
emboldened or activated, have everything fit the task. The stories we tell ourselves, our self-talk, the internal conversation,
often
frames our experience to either sustain it
or derail it.
Self-awareness, which is crucial
in both monitoring
and understanding this process.
The most common
reason you don't get what you want
is the story
you tell yourself
about why
you can't have it.
I've included
in the outline, and I won't go
through all of
them here, or in detail there.
Engineering
professors David Franklin and Daniel Wolpert
identified
five
mechanisms
of brain operation
when someone
successfully bounces back and reframes failure to engage in a positive way.
Each brain mechanism
has a specific corresponding brain function
to allow
access to create an inner dialogue
to create
rebound as well as resilience.
I'll just name
the five
and look in your
outline because there's a little bit more detail.
To redirect
negative feedback.
And a reflection
question here is, what can I learn from this? What are the possibilities that we follow?
Two, recognize
that obstacles are created.
If they're not there
until you create them.
And the self-reflection
question here would be,
what would it be like
to not create the obstacle and instead put the energy into what I want?
Three, use
systematic forecasting.
A self-reflection question.
Is my usual pattern awkward for this situation?
Four, assess
your current model. Self-reflect.
Is this plan
really working or not?
And five.
The output channel is essential.
No matter how much
we acquire information,
data,
study, and learn, it's by putting it into action. This output channel
that we create
effectiveness
and a performance
memory.
So a simple
self-reflection question here.
What do I do next
to put this into action?
So let's look a bit at performing
under pressure. All teams, ranging from business organizations to sports,
like to think
they do their best when the stakes are highest, when the future rests
on the immediate outcome. But we know now
that's not how it happens. How you handle yourself in difficult and challenging moments determines success more than how you handle yourself at normal times.
In extensive studies
of teams,
Professor Heidi Gardner
at Harvard saw three performance pressure patterns that compromise results.
When teams,
and this is from sports to executive teams, become caught up in the risk of failure rather than the pursuit of excellence,
they revert
to more standard and safe practices instead of seeking original solutions or to the default mode rather than game plan.
Secondly,
when teams face significant performance pressure, they tend to defer to high status members
rather than using
expert members and information to proceed in a novel way.
And third, when an individual
or team fails to perform well, when strongly favored or squanders a big lead in an important event,
it can be
a response to excessive pressure.
So research on performing
under pressure consistently shows that most people perform below their capacity when under pressure.
This is so much an important issue
for us as mentor coaches to help our clients recognize
situation.
And
this research on performing under pressure, most people find below their capacity.
This occurs
in instances ranging from parallel parking and driving tests,
the job interview,
to making a business deal.
Pressure can
erode behavioral skills
and
ability to perform unless it's managed in an informed, systematic manner, and then people can exceed their expectations and have new levels of
success.
This is where we come in as coaches.
So our
attention, judgment, and decision making
can
be adversely affected if we get caught up in the fear of failure or in any other diversion from the flow
of
engagement and performance.
If we step back
and play it safe instead of
sustaining
that immersion in the performance zone, this can compromise things.
Now, there's
more detail here on the three simple definitions that I just want to highlight here, because as coaches, we'll be dealing with all of these with our clients. Stress is generated in any situation when there's the experience of too many demands and too few resources to meet those demands.
Energy,
time, or money.
Or
if the focus tries to encompass
too much.
Secondly, pressure
is
the experience of the significance we give a situation, the expectations we place on our performance,
and
the stake in the outcome. I'll give you an example in just a second.
State of mind
is a mind-body state. This, I believe, is the most important thing that we do as mentor coaches, is to help our clients become aware and focus on how they regulate
states of mind,
manage emotions, and sustain this framework of experience to engage what they do.
State of mind
is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavioral patterns,
as we discussed
in our first seminar.
So let's talk
about
how to develop
resilience in performance.
Success
most often has to do with how we manage our internal state under pressure-inducing circumstances.
How we develop
resilience in performance becomes an important aspect.
Theo Epstein
guided the Boston Red Sox to their first World Series victory in 86 years.
Then he agreed
in 2011 to lead the Chicago Cubs, whose last World Series championship was in 1908.
The Cubs then won
in 2016, 108 years later.
Epstein was widely
touted as having an erratic and rare intelligence
to deconstruct the situation
to its simplest form
and generate
strategic possibilities.
He was asked
how he decides
what he looks for
in putting together
a team.
He indicated that he scouts
the person
more than the player.
Epstein said
the first thing he wants to know about any potential player
is how has he handled
adversity.
Resilience
grows by converting mistakes into lessons.
What we regularly do
with our
by reflecting on,
by reflecting on and learning from mistakes, the growth mindset,
we convert
maybe a regrettable experience into a learning experience.
So resilience
is
the result of moderating
and constructively harnessing
any stress response.
Success in any arena hinges on this resilience, this process.
Management of setbacks
to productively progress becomes an essential aspect of optimum performance
in whatever endeavor.
Persistence toward a goal in the face of challenges
characterizes success
for athletes
to executives. A resilient individual
is not somebody who avoids stress,
but somebody
who learns how to effectively master it and optimize performance while doing it, to sustain a focus in that performance zone throughout the experience.
And studies show that someone
can boost resilience
by these four strategies.
Reinterpreting a negative event, which is simply reframing.
Let me tell you
the problem. This is where
you may want to
consider interrupting to
look together at what are the possibilities here
to enhance positive emotions,
to become physically fit, and to maintain
a supported social network to imitate resilience role models.
The ability to regulate
stress of mind and manage emotions is central in establishing resilience.
A couple of approaches in recent research
has shown that
two things
can help regulate state of mind and enhance resilience. Cognitive reappraisal, which is simply reframing, which is what we've just been discussing.
A Mount Sinai
School of Medicine study of Vietnam vets found that those who had actively reappraised their imprisonment to find meaningful ways in which to grow stronger and more resilient showed the most adaptive responses.
The second is mindfulness meditation.
It's a model of collective focus,
management
of any interference
of that focus
by letting the thought go and refocusing on breathing and the immersion of that sustained and exclusive focus.
This has been
associated with improved ability in coaching. Some of you have heard me use this model as one way to think about how you engage your client. You focus just on your client and the client's story throughout the session.
Associated with
increased flexibility of thinking
and
even greater psychological well-being.
And remember there
was an exercise in your outline from last seminar about one version of mindfulness meditation. See what you think about it.
So both cognitive
reappraisal and mindfulness meditation can activate, have been shown to activate the left prefrontal cortex, a brain activation pattern that's associated with greater emotional control, a boost of positive emotions, and faster recovery from discomfort.
So here's a brief overview
of how the neural conditioning chart and the page that has this is in the back of the outline in the resources section.
In the emotional triggers column,
pick one or two emotional triggers that you're aware of
that instantly induce
an emotional reaction. You get derailed and immediately boots up a mindset that you're focused on that problem or that issue. And the second problem,
usual response,
right? Your usual reaction or behavior or feeling for each of these emotional triggers.
The purpose of both of these two columns
is to cue your radar to be instantly aware when there's an emotional trigger and how you respond.
The response
in the second column, the negative self-talk, the stress, whatever it is, is the result of a state change,
not the cause,
as we often attribute.
So I would suggest
that you establish an appointment with yourself, say for 20 minutes, and pick a couple of emotional triggers that
are guaranteed to be triggering,
to derail you. Write those down and write down your usual responses, whatever the thoughts, the feelings, the behaviors are,
and pause.
Pause.
sure you're not triggering yourself in doing this, but you're observing. And the idea here is to be aware of this process more quickly so that you can engage column 3 and column 4. Come back with another appointment with yourself, maybe for 15 or 20 minutes, and look at developing a mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology, and what your ideal response to that emotional trigger will be. We'll talk more about this and the detail of this, but keep in mind that this is called neural conditioning because you're rewiring your brain, and you go across horizontally from
the emotional trigger
to the mantra,
the idea,
and to the ideal response. When you repeat that enough, you'll rewire your brain so that
you'll be
cued automatically for that ideal behavior instead of getting trapped in the time capsule of that second call.
Those responses,
feelings, behaviors
are not going
to change.
So here's
just a quick example of
framing
and how it can be effective.
So what is the effect
on performance
of
positive versus negative
framing?
Play to win versus play not to lose.
Here's an example. For a soccer penalty kick,
everybody's the same 12 yards away.
A 72 square foot target
guarded by one goalie.
Now, when playing to win,
when making the goal will result in a win. There's a tie, the game is over, there's one penalty kick.
When the goalie makes the goal,
it results in a win.
Kickers are successful
92% of the time.
When playing not to lose,
the team is down by one.
Out of regulation play.
There's one kick left. If you make it, you tie. And if you miss, your team will lose. So you're playing not to lose. Success rate is 62%.
Everything else
is the same except the frame.
Same distance,
same target,
two different mindsets.
30% difference in success rate.
In the threat mindset,
expectations are high.
There may be a feeling of pressure
or judgment.
You can't make a mistake,
which is,
if you focus on that,
you're playing not to lose.
Remember, we get
what we focus on.
The result
may be more anxiety and a slightly different mindset from the playing to win mindset.
Playing to win is based on confidence
rather than fear.
To optimize performance
rather than not to lose.
To thrive rather than survive.
To create optimal experience
rather than to avoid a stressful one.
Playing to win enhances abilities and results.
Playing not to lose
compromises expression of those same abilities.
So a couple of things
I want to mention just in an overview, and there's more detail in the outline. Performance can depend on whether and how you interpret anxiety or excitement.
A worry, a thought,
a fear of failure can boot up the mindset to avoid pain and play not to lose.
So let's consider,
and I think you'll hear
each of these
with some of your clients in the future.
The four most common success completion issues.
Choking, sandbagging,
self-handicapping,
and burnout. And
just a brief note
about
how to address each.
First, choking.
When Jackie Robinson
grabbed his throat
in a game between
St. Louis and the Dodgers, when umpire Bill Stewart badly missed a call,
threw him out of the game.
Choking became a common term for you blew it.
Choking usually refers
to not executing a specific skill under pressure that you'd more likely execute flawlessly under normal circumstances.
So,
so
common scenarios of choking, how you may hear it in class. Watching a routine behavior.
Flubbing
a well-practiced presentation. Forgetting lines that an actor has said hundreds of times. Blanking on the name of someone you know quite well. In a significant circumstance.
So understanding
how choking happens can help reduce the occurrence and, I think, promote optimal performance. When any performer shifts from a bottom-up to a top-down system to think about something,
about
a technique or execution, or wanting to be sure not to make a mistake, this alters the performance flow. Athletic, intellectual, any skill. So what do you do?
Two behaviors
increase pressure and distort the ability to perform under pressure. This is something we may want to listen for with our clients.
Framing
the situation as a unique experience. This is my biggest game. There will never be an opportunity like this again. Today I make history. With that, you can only play, not to lose. Thinking of a pressure moment as a single shot heightens the sense of risk and loss. With athletes, for example, loss aversion creates a behavior of playing not to lose.
An example.
In the 2017 American League Baseball Championships, the starting Astros pitcher, this was back when I was an Astros fan, in game three against the Yankees was Charlie Martin. When I saw him interview before the game, he said, "This is the biggest game of my life." And my response, time again as an Astro fan, was, "Oh, no. The Yankees got 6 runs in the first 2 innings. Now, see how right my grandmother was. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. And secondly, exaggerating the situation, becoming too attached to the outcome, intensifying any fear or anxiety versus the success in that mindset. Anxiety shifts the state so that whatever we do loses focus and moves away from working memory to what can go wrong. The meaning we ascribe to an event then dictates our response. So changing how we view anxiety, how we frame anxiety and pressure can change the impact. Our greatest challenge, the greatest need as mentor coaches, is to be aware, I believe, of how to regulate states of mind through various emotional triggers in charged situations, including extreme success, maybe the greatest challenge, for ourselves and our clients. We're going to return to that last in our next seminar. So in high-pressure situations, to remain focused and regulate a state of mind affects both mindset and behavior.
Here's an example.
In research examining 185 venture capital pitches, variables such as calmness, passion, eye contact, and confidence were significantly greater predictors of outcome than content, experience, and expertise.
These
responses to pressure to sustain a balanced state of mind and specific mindset of confidence ensured the most favorable outcomes.
Second area,
health handicaps.
Dr. Eddie
O'Connor reports the recognition of his process of self-handicapping himself as a runner. He recognized when he didn't reach his goal for the half mile in 2:10, that he was holding himself back to have something left at the end of each race and coupled it with the hope that he could get there the next time by trying harder. He paid that price to keep hope alive. He recognized that preserving the hope of doing better was actually interfering with doing better.
Self-handicaps
are performance barriers or inhibitions created to protect a sense of self-esteem or pride.
If there's a failure,
then self-talk can become, well, it isn't because of poor ability, but some outside circumstance
to preserve to preserve hope.
I can always try harder.
Remedy?
The remedy for self-handicaps?
Self-reflection.
Awareness. And awareness of the process.
Third,
sandbagging.
Sandbagging.
Sandbagging attempts to demonstrate in some way a limitation or a negative aspect to diminish others' expectations of you.
Sandbagging
is designed to diminish the pressure of performance anxiety.
Well,
I may have lost, but it doesn't really count because I didn't give 100%.
Both
self-handicapping and sandbagging are designed to preserve integrity and to avoid pain, yet they both produce the results they attempt to avoid. A specific remedy for sandbagging,
awareness
of the process and changing self-talk.
And four,
burnout.
Burnout
is a syndrome that's comprised of a collection of aspects, including a diminished emotional drive, diminished concentration, lessened motivation and enthusiasm, or some combination of these and perhaps others.
Often
the result of a chronic experience of stressful performance.
The experience
of resulting attention, fatigue, and lethargy
create
a lessened desire, a reduced desire to engage with passion and consistency.
So the
remedy for burnout, mindfulness with reappraisal and re-engagement.
And this
will be an aspect of
some
of your work as coaches. So one question may
illuminate
an aspect of this potential.
At what
percent of your capacity are you functioning in this position? And to begin the self-assessment from there.
So in the outline again,
there are some pressure management tools,
steps
that can be useful. I suggest looking at those. I'm not going over them now because of time, but those are systematic.
Done in sequence.
You're shooting most effectively in the order that I have, beginning with grounding and centering, and then looking at applying a systematic way to address self-regulation and focus on creating and sustaining a performance in a system.
So we will be
talking about
the roadmap
in our next seminar.
The
roadmap system can help you develop awareness of states of mind. The roadmap is more of a reference for us as coaches. It's not an exercise to go through with a client, but simply a macro system to understand the algorithms of how we construct stories and also how we might be able to apply this in listening to the stories of our clients and in going through this systematic assessment and application to facilitate and be a catalyst to help our clients develop better stories.
So what I would suggest for you as an exercise, return to your neural chart.
Look at the first emotional trigger that you wrote.
Now, the roadmap is also detailed.
In the resources section. Look at the roadmap system and go through these seven steps
to
look at that issue as a prompt to reflect on
your story.
To illustrate how you may understand and apply this.
The roadmap.
Recognize the emotional trigger for your state of mind, column one.
Second, observe
the state change
that will follow. Third,
access the ideal state of mind for the task.
Three.
Column three.
a mantra to get grounded and centered. Four, decide on a predetermined strategy. Column four, which tool you may use, what an ideal response or behavior would be.
Next,
map the next best action.
Author
the ideal experience, and then execute that optimum performance. In the P of the roadmap, program your peak performance identity to transform how and who you see yourself doing and being in that performance zone. Incorporate the new behavior as part of your core self. One of the most powerful forces, probably the most powerful force of the human psyche, is we always return to our core identity. You know, like when someone trips, you learn their native language. When new behavior is incorporated into core identity, and the operating system of our client is revised collaboratively, it becomes funny. Change that lasts becomes then the default mode. Your brain is rewired.
This is what
makes change permanent.
If you just do a
different behavior and you don't do this process of incorporating it into your operating system, you'll revert soon enough back to the usual way or the default way of responding. So I hope this has been helpful. I welcome any questions. Since we didn't have a discussion beginning and end, any questions, any clarifications, I'll work them into our discussion at the beginning of our fourth seminar next Monday. Thank you, and again, my apologies for the glitches that we did it this way, and your time, those of you who attended, was not used in an effective way with an active